apologize to Mr. Goldberg for the slight delay starting. A number of members had flown in this morning and they were delayed in the flight. A very warm welcome to you.
At front of the struggle. And the Evening Post, for which I worked, was is actually mentioned in Mr. Mandela's book. And it was very interesting for me as a young man to move into that environment. And then I took over from Mr. Sutherland as editor of the Evening Post in 1978. And I remained as editor there for 21 years and went off on early retirement in 1999. And I was succeeded by Lakela Kulunda, whom you may know. She took over as editor, and I think she works in Parliament here now. During that period, we were very involved, obviously, with production of a daily newspaper, but also very aware of the needs of the community in Port Elizabeth. A lot of people who didn't have access to the newspaper, and we set about trying to reach the community and those who wouldn't normally read a newspaper. We ran many supplements, educational supplements. We linked up with the Soul City organization, and we assisted them in promoting their TV series. We ran supplements on that, on health. And then we also became aware that there were quite a few among our readership who were not reading the newspaper. There were items in there that were not of interest to them. And we just felt that we needed to make some kind of arrangement in a smallish paper where we could have news of interest to the whole community. So what we did was we created a new edition for the paper. We took out things which related specifically to the white readership, and we replaced those in the special edition with things of direct community interest to the folk in the townships. Went very well. It eventually became our biggest edition, as we got a whole lot of new readers. Just as a matter of interest, in the end, in the late 80s, it actually came back to bite us, because a lot of the politicians accused us of running an apartheid edition, which wasn't the idea at all. It was simply to reach out to the community. But had a session with some of the ANC leaders at the time there, and they understood what we were trying to do. We weren't trying to be political, we were actually trying to reach the community. We understood the community needs. So say I took early retirement in 1999, and a little while after that came back to Cape Town here. I'd been involved in various things. I lectured journalism at Varsity College for a year, and then in 2005, I worked as an interim station manager for a community radio station, where I got a good understanding of what community media is all about and understood some of the problems. So when I saw this advertisement and I heard that you were looking for somebody to sit on this board, I just felt that I had much to offer from my career and also the specific interest that I do have in making sure that we reach out to the community. And as I said, that working for the radio station, I realized that there are many folk out there who don't have access to the main media, written media, and have been bypassed by the broadcast media, so that we were able to hone in specifically on that. So that just roughly is my background. You have read my CV, I'm sure, so I think probably any question that you'd like to ask, our time would be better served answering some of your questions directly.
Thank you very much.
Chairperson, thank you. You must forgive me if my phone keeps ringing. I'm deliberately not switching it off. All the vacancies that is still available, so I'm not going to switch it off, even if you instruct me. I'm not taking that chance to have it off. So, but you've got a very interesting CV and a lot of experience. What I've noticed, and I could be completely wrong, that it seems like you didn't attend university. You don't have that kind of qualification. Because I'm interested, because there's a perception for you to do well. You you have to get have a degree. Of course, it's helpful and all of that, but you seem to be, from your CV, it's not only you, it seems to be the opposite. That I believe that through experience and passion, all of that can also come up on top. So, am I right when I read your CV like that?
When I went into journalism in 1960, there were no journalism schools at the universities at all, and the newspapers undertook their own training. Most of the major companies ran the courses for the fact they called them newspaper cadet reporter courses and went through it very much on the job training, and we all learned that way. So most of the people in journalism at that stage learned on the job. Later on, some of the universities introduced journalism courses. We encourage people to go on those, but that's the reason that I didn't go at that stage. That was very much on the job training, yeah. And as I said there, we went through these different courses, not just at the beginning, but throughout that learning period, various courses and so on that were run by the industry.
And I just what I read in the CV and what I've just heard have simply confirmed my impression. I would think that yours are precisely the kind of qualifications appropriate to a body like the MDVA. I'm curious to ask, that the kids that you've been teaching at Varsity College, how successful is that? That must give you a good sense of what talent is available out there. They presumably want to go into the established media. So out of curiosity, what sort of talent do you see there? And then I would think that precisely the fact that you come out of the old cadet school, that is the way South African journalism used to work, surely that places you very well in the case of little media, which we're trying to start up, both in print and with community radio stations. Surely that positions you extremely well to assist them. You really do know the business and every side of it.
Yes, I think that I'm in the fortunate position where I've seen both sides of it, on the job practical training, and then also being exposed to the academic side, where again, because even though I didn't have tertiary education, they recognised that I was able to offer much to these students, and it was a very interesting experience. Sometimes very frustrating with these 18-year-olds who wouldn't come to class, and some of them wouldn't learn and so on. But it just exposed me again to where the young people are, how they were thinking, and I just realized again and from my working experience is that there needs to be some foundational work and some input into the lives of folk who are very keen on journalism. And I was quite surprised about how raw some of them actually were. Many of them hadn't read newspapers. They hadn't had much exposure, and somehow they just thought that it would be nice to work for a newspaper. But it was encouraging to see how they developed over the time and how their writing developed and the interest. And I encouraged them to read newspapers. And what I encouraged them to do also there was to actually try to get into community newspapers to start off. I told them that that's where they would learn the business. If they went to a small community paper, they'd be required to do everything that was there, and that was the way to learn. And many of them did that. And I think one of the things that I learned working with the community radio was that we could quite easily bring in people who were studying to work for a while, for a few hours a day at the newspapers, at the radio station, to get that experience. And I think that is an area that community papers could tap into, to actually use interns and to, again, learn on the job and to put into practice some of the things that they've learned, which I encourage my students to do. So that most of these knock and drops and other community papers would take them, and if they were prepared to even work for nothing, it would benefit them in the long run. And those who did was of tremendous value to them.
Don't
mine, say, will be a very short one. Recently, through the public discourse, there's been a call that the government policy around the issue of affirmative action and other related policies should seek to redress the ills of the past has come under scrutiny or under attack. Now, when you look at the MDDA Act in particular, it's also talking about redressing some of the historical disadvantaged communities and so on. What is your view in that matter? Do you think maybe it's time that they should quit the policy of addressing the ills of the past, or is it still relevant to continue to do that? I'm just raising that because MDDA is one of the institutions which is trying to address some of the ills of the past.
I think it was very necessary to have that, and I think there were not a lot of journalists in the mainstream newspapers who were not white, and we at the Evening Post made a special effort to use many folk who were not white, but I know that it wasn't general throughout the industry, and we had several reporters. Did you know Jimmy Machudo, Mona Badella from that area? All of these people worked for us for years, and we brought young people in, and I think that a lot has changed over the years since the introduction of affirmative action. There have been many more black journalists in the business. They have helped with the training of new ones, new people in there. We brought senior people in, and they've been able to encourage others, and I think from my observation that many of the newspapers today have a large number of very capable black news people who certainly can hold their own on merit. They wouldn't have to rely on affirmative action at all. Very qualified people, and right through journalism, through political reporting, through general reporting, even sports reporting. And so I'm very encouraged by what I see, what has happened, and the success of bringing folk in and training.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. I'm guess is a follow-up to what Eric has asked, but for me it's more about the possibility of really putting the disadvantaged communities at par with the entire community and the entire South Africa. Is it achievable through the type of budget and institutions that we have, like MDDA and MISA, or should we do more as politicians to try and increase either the budget for development, media development and diversity, or do you think that we might as well get them into the mainstream media?
I must say, just speaking from my experience running a community radio station for a year, we were very limited financially, we were very limited by what we could do, and then the DOC came in with funding, and we were able to produce programs that promoted health. We had programs on crime, HIV, AIDS, many areas that affected the community. And we were able to do that with support of the DOC. But one of the interesting things is that the DOC required from us to account in great detail of how we were spending the money. And I remember we produced some programs and we had to submit to the DOC first just to make sure that we were doing what they were paying us to do. And some of these were sent back to us to say, this is a bit of a slapdash job that you did on this and you need to do it again. So there was accountability, but we were able to do and produce programs which were of tremendous value to the community. So I think that financing is needed. One needs to look at those areas, and many of these community newspapers that are out there, community radio stations, are very, very cash strapped. I know that at the radio station where I was, most of the people worked without being paid. About 75 volunteers, I think, and came in every day to do a job of work. We paid some of them and minimal wages. With the DSC money, we were able to pay some people to come in, some people with a bit of expertise, and to produce programs that were going to be of tremendous value to the community. And I realize that there are many people out there, again, who tune in to community stations, who read community newspapers because they address their needs. Very often the mainstream newspapers have a buckshot appeal, where it goes over the heads of so many people in the community, and not just in rural areas, but in the urban areas. And we had tremendous response from our listeners, and more, in fact, than I think we ever got as a daily newspaper, because we were addressing directly the needs and the concerns of people in the community, many of them illiterate, but we were able to reach through the medium of radio and through the media, and because, to a large extent, support from people like the DOC. I went up to a conference that the DOC organized as well, where there were over 100 community radio stations too, and that was the experience of many of these that I spoke to, some of them very small, very few people, but who made a huge impact and are still making a huge impact in the community, which I don't believe would have happened at all if it were not for the support of government and people outside who've been able to, who've actually seen the vision, seen the need to try and reach every member of the population, no matter where they are socially, in every other way.
What is your understanding of diversity in the media? I think a lot of your work is on development work, in journalism, etc. But how do you conceptualize this concept of diversity? And the second question is, how do you think we can change the patterns of media ownership?
I think with diversity, to my mind, we're looking at empowering groups that do not have access to the media, not just getting them as readers, but allowing groups, rural areas and urban areas as well, to be able to be involved in the production process of the media. People who are from the communities that you're trying to reach, who understand what is needed in the community, understand the education side of it, understand the straight news value side of things, and just keeping people informed, and just real local community issues. And I think from what I've seen from community papers, there's a huge amount that still can be done. People who are still not being reached, people who have not had the opportunity, have not had the means. It's not one can't just start a radio station or start a newspaper, but there needs to be that support. And I just felt that an organization like this, which has the means to be able to get involved and to meet the needs of those sorts of communities that do need to be reached. What was your other question? Ownership. That's always been a difficult one, because you're looking at economic issues here, and you're talking mainly about your big newspaper groups. I think there has been a lot of diversification there through VE and so on, but it's difficult to know how to do that, because these major companies obviously have to remain economically viable. They brought people in at the ground level, but I'm not too sure how one would handle that with the major companies. You obviously bring in as shareholders, empowerment groups that are there, which has been done, but I'm sure that there's a lot more that can be done. Exactly how that can be done, I'm not too sure. Those are big issues, and involve shareholders and big money. So I'm afraid I can't help you anymore than that. Yeah.
think there's an issue for me that following up to the last question for the ownership, whether do you believe that government have to intervene, whether as a matter of policy or whatever, or we leave the market to play out itself? According to yourself, in what should happen? Because the issue of ownership, I think, is a very critical issue. If you want to make sure that those who are previously disadvantaged do come to the mainstream and so on. So how do you think they achieve? But you know the argument is always between the government intervention or you leave the market to play it out and then eventually the normal process of market will always people will go in and so on. What is your view on that particular?
That has been and still is a very tricky issue, because I think once you get government involved, you run the danger of the government trying to dictate to the media what they should run, how they should run it, and so on. And obviously, one of the basic tenets of a democracy is to have a press that is unfettered, that the freedom of expression is able to operate without fear of government intervention. And I believe that there are enough safeguards in the system, and if they're not, they can be implemented there, but to ensure that that there is fair, honest reporting. I'm serving on the Press Council at the moment, where many complaints come in about the media, and one of the discussions within the Press Council is to introduce more measures there where a newspaper has been found guilty of transgressing the press code, where there can be greater punishment, where there can be financial implications there. At the moment, we're quite limited in what we can do. But I think once you get statutory implications there, government involvement, you're running into a very, very difficult area. And the previous government tried to do that, and it was very difficult for them. During those states of emergency that we had, it was extremely difficult to report the truth. Things were happening in the townships, there was unrest, and we were unable to report what was happening because we first had to get police clearance before we could publish anything that related to riots, to police action, and so on. And when the change came to the New South Africa, I was so grateful because I thought, well, now we can write about what is really happening in the community. And I think that is the line that we've got to try to find, that it is the responsibility of the media to get the truth out there. Not biased, not distorted, but the truth. And when they don't do that, then obviously they can be brought to book through the courts and through other channels that they are. But we need to be very careful that when we try to keep our people informed of what is happening, that we don't restrict the media in their job in trying to do that. Have I answered your question, or have I gone off, digressed?
The issue which I'm raising is that as long as the reports or the media reports are accurate, correct, it's fine, the issue of ownership. But I'm betting on the issue of ownership, because you see currently the ownership is only on the few. Those who have been previously advantaged, they still hold the ownership of media in majority. So I'm just saying, if the media, the reports are accurate and so on, we must not worry about the ownership. We must just say, as long as the media, the reports are accurate, it's fine. Government must just relax, the market will sort itself out, or the media will sort itself out. But now we're 14 years down the line, and from where I am, I don't see any movement drastically in terms of the ownership and so on. And that's why I'm saying, what's your view around that? That specific matter of ownership.
I think, as I said before, it's a very difficult one. I think that there should be greater involvement from the community in the ownership. I believe efforts have been made. There have been arrangements with various groups who've been brought in and so on. And I must just tell you that all the time that I was an editor, never once
was there any interference from any of the owner. Never. I never ever met anybody from Anglo-American who at that time were involved with the newspaper. And as a newspaper editor, I had more involvement from the government of the time than from any owner. So from what goes into the newspaper, the ownership factor is not an issue. Obviously, where the owners have input is who they appoint as editors, and that is where it stops. And I was told once you're appointed, that's it. And today you have many black editors, and they are also allowed to carry on and do their own thing. If you really blow it, the only thing they can do is hire you, and then they would have to have a very good reason. I've been an editor during the old regime and the new one, and I must tell you, being an editor under the new regime was a lot better than under the old one. And when I was an editor too, Cyril Ramaphosa was chairman of our board, and we had quite a few sessions with Cyril, and he told us a few things which he suggested, realized that he couldn't have. But one of the things that he came up with, which I think brings out your point to where ownership can have an influence, he came out very strongly at that time, which was in the early 90s, and he felt that the mainstream newspapers were not reporting enough on the rest of Africa. It was about South Africa and about Europe and America, and he said the rest of Africa was ignored. And that's a change that has taken place in newspapers. We actually listened to him and said, yeah, he's absolutely quite right. He didn't say we must, but that was his input, and I think newspapers have changed. And if you look today, you'll see that there's a far greater coverage of Africa. So you're quite right in that sense, that when you have that representation in the ownership, that's the kind of influence that comes through. And hopefully that will continue and will increase, and we'll see that reflected in the newspapers.
Mr. Voltbeck, there are strong perceptions out there that are saying the South African media, both electronic and print, but more especially print media, is more sympathetic to capital or to the rich people. And the manifestation of that is seen in their articles. For instance, if there's an African person who is painted by white people because they've stolen something, you know the story. That will not go that much. It will come, but it's not really something, a big issue. But if you get, let's say, a judge, for instance, the story of a judge who that story, it will be headlines non-stop. But the story of a white person who has thrown people to a lion's den or painted them because of whatever, it's not really a big story. Now, those are perceptions that I'm advancing up in. Now, if you were to rate the South African media in what I'm saying, what rating would you give? Would you say it's false perception? Would you say it's correct? Your analysis of the reporting of the journalist. In South Africa, how is it? What is your view? Would you take the side that says it's more inclined to the rich, or it's balanced, or more inclined to the poor? What would your rating?
Yeah, obviously, one has to not speak in generalizations because it does differ from newspaper to newspaper. I think the overriding principle really is that the newspapers work on is news value. So there's great news value when somebody who is well known and is important runs foul of the law or does something that is significant. Everybody will read that because they know the person that you write about. But there are obviously many other issues too that need to be reported and probably are not reported. That one throwing somebody to the lions, I think that was very well reported. In fact, they threw that man in to the lions. So that was well reported. But there are obviously other issues as well. I think we can do the newspaper industry. I don't say we because I'm not in there anymore, but could do a better job. But there are many limitations. I mean, I know of things that happen that seem to me to be very important. Crime and accidents and so on, and I look in the newspaper and I don't see it covered at all, and I think to myself, well, that to me was something quite important and it should have been there, and that goes across the board, applying to people who are rich and poor and so on, and I think newspapers are quite limited to that. One of the facts of life is that in the old days a lot of the reporting, particularly in the cities, it did involve white people. And a lot of what happened outside of those areas were not reported. Nowadays, that has definitely changed. And from what I can see, my observation is that there is a great effort to try and cover very widely. And also because the staffs of the different newspapers reflect more the wider community, so there's a much greater area to cover, and it's not very easy to obviously cover everything that is going on. And I think you're quite right, there are instances where greater coverage is given to people who are perhaps in authority, well known and so on, and sometimes more than is necessary. But I think that there are very many practical problems involved in that as well. But as I say, that is changing with the changing complexion of the newspaper newsrooms.
Sure.
Is there any do you believe that the journalists are independent in their perception of the attributes? Because you didn't answer my question that saying the rating. So you just answered general and said the general question. Now a direct question, do you believe that the journalists are independent or their stories reflect the ideological makeup of their voices?
Yeah, I don't think a journalist is independent. The mainstream papers, they are under the authority of those who are the editor and other senior people in the newspapers. The ideology of the newspaper is reflected in whoever the editor is as well, and a reporter will be guided in this is the way we want this written. They won't be asked to tell lies and so on, but the type of story that is covered and so on will be reflected by who is the editor and the view of the editor. And I think as you look at newspapers, you will actually get an idea of who is what and what kind of direction they take. And very often a newspaper will quite clearly take up a stand to say, we support this movement or that movement or this party or that party. And
And so as you read that paper, you will see that that's what they do. And the journalist is responsible and may be told to follow a certain angle on the story. I've seen it happen, and I know it still does happen.
Thank you very much for your time. Okay, we must apologize for the delay. You know, you've had butterflies in this time very early this morning. And thank you for coming along and participating in the meeting. Thank you very much. We can get the next person. Yeah. Am I pronouncing it correctly? You've been through this procedure previously. You after the privacy system, your term has ended in the NDDA. Coming to an end. Okay, so you've been through this procedure already. Thank you very much for coming in time and waiting for us. We apologize for the delay. The procedure is very simple. You will speak to your CV for 3 to 5 minutes. You don't have to read everything, but just take us through. Part of your background, and then why you think you'd be a worthy candidate for the NDDA, and why you think you should be given a second chance to serve on this particular aspect. So,
thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to the committee. I am a committed South African, committed to the change that is needed by this country so that we, the citizens, in particular poor and working people, can actually claim their full citizenship. And the media is an important tool to allow citizens, particularly poor and working people, to stake their claim in what the country offers. In my view, the MDDA has an important role to play in that regard, and I think that to the MDDA I bring a set of values, set of skills, experiences, expertise and energy that can ensure that the MDDA enables citizens to play the kind of role that is not just mine, but I think is allowed for, is provided for in the Constitution and the MDDA Act. I have extensive experience as a development worker, development activist across a range of sectors, HIV/AIDS, cooperatives, local economic development, but in addition to that, I combine that with a set of extensive skills and experience also in the media sector itself, having been a spokesperson of the CCP previously, but also serving a number of boards of organizations that are active in the media sector, including the community media, the Community Health Media Trust, which produces the budget program on SABC every Sunday and Thursday. And I think that that experience, those skills, but also the values and the energy I bring will now help to consolidate the MDDA at least at a board level, and the MDDA also is beginning to mobilize more resources, but also in its strategy going forward from now is beginning to move beyond grant funding to actually execute other parts of its mandate, which have to do, for example, with practical interventions or commentary on the state of development and diversification of the media in South Africa. So for all those reasons, Chairperson, I think I'm putting myself
Zafar just touched at the very end there on what I really want to know, which is what have you achieved for the MDDA? But also, please give us an insight into how well it's working and what the needs are, and therefore what you would be able to bring to it if reappointed in the light of what the needs are at present. But give us a good sense, give us some insight into how things are going at the MDDA.
The MDDA has been very fortunate from the word go to have, with the first board, a board which has the responsibility to set up the organization, the policies, the procedures, appoint the CEO with limited resources. So there was prudence from the word go. When I joined, I think it was some 2-3 years after the first board, and already when I joined the board, there was that stability, that sense of commitment on the part of the board. And I think all the subsequent appointments have actually contributed to that. And all the key officials, so like the CEO or the chairperson or even board committees, have actually played an effective role to ensure that MDDA executes its mandate within limited resources. My specific contribution has been in 3 areas. The current chairperson of the tender committee, whereby we basically have been processing the supply chain management process, but in addition to that, we have reviewed the policy and procedures in that regard, and we have put in place now a much more extensive set of policies and procedures, which I like with several pieces of legislation, the PFMA in particular. The previous policy had several weaknesses and loopholes which could have exposed the organization in a problematic way. In our instance, we did not have to wait for a crisis to hit us before we actually ensured that we would comply. We were very fortunate because these were comments on the audit committee that came through to say that from time to time you need to look at your policies, and I ensured that in our committee that I chair, we actually spend the time to go through witnesses that actually correct them. I think in my role as a committee, we've been effective in that regard. My other 3 contributions are really in the area of what the strategic plan of the MDDA says now. We have just commissioned a research project on ownership trends, ownership and control trends. Will be launched perhaps in May when the research is complete next year. That is now an indicator of a move by the MDDA to other parts of its mandate, whereby up to now we've been focusing on grant funding. That would be the first serious exploration of the control and ownership of the media outside, being done by an agency outside of commercial media in South Africa. And that would be that statement we hope will be definitive in terms of what the challenges are and what needs to be done. Of course, there's going to be a major debate about what does that mean for autonomy and independence. So I think there has to be readiness for that kind of debate, which has to be mature and informed on the basis of fact, but also informed by the commitment of the Act to develop and diversify the media. That's the one area. That's the second contribution. We spend time. I'm actually chairing a subcommittee, an ad hoc subcommittee of the board, which is overlooking, what's the word? Paying oversight over the research process. Yeah. And then the other thing, which is the strategic plan, which I've contributed to, is the recognition of the strategic plan and also in budgets of the MDDA starting this year, for work to be done to promote media cooperatives, not just narrowly cooperatives insofar as a group of people who come together, but serious questions about whether the problems community media is facing cannot be addressed by looking at an approach which can build economies of scale. For example, there's a hub that the MDDA is part of promoting in the Eastern Cape, which could bring in all sorts of conventions, but also the way in which it can bring together print or radio
strategy is being implemented as we speak. The last part, which I think I've contributed significantly, is a bit of a challenge. It's within the documents, the MDA has referred to it as atypical media. Basically, your trade unions, all 60-something of them in the country, or your NGOs, they do not have the problem of funding media production. They've got the money for that, but they cannot distribute. And existing community media also does not benefit from the resources that NGOs and trade unions hold. So my dream, which I think has also brought to the table of the MBTA, was, look, you take one union, let's take up to 200,000 members, teachers, they produce the educator's voice every month. It gets piled up in union offices. Now, the constituent they serve is a constituent that is not necessarily represented in the media. So there's a problem that this thing is not distributed. But another dimension, they pay about 3 million rands a month for the production of this thing. Whereas, if there was a partnership properly conceptualized, properly structured with a media co-op or an existing community newspaper to arrange for the community journalists or the law of that community newspaper to actually work to produce and also even to consider distributing, then what you do immediately, you link those in the community media with those who are employed, but also you address the long-term cash flow crisis beyond an MDTA grant of that community media station. So that work is in the document now. The question is going to be, how does then the MDTA staff actually go out to ensure that unions, NGOs, you can even think of churches in some instances, which also have some resources for them. So that actually these resources amplify what the MDTA contributes. That is exciting for me as a possibility. The challenge is going to be how is the elaborated in the next 2 or 3 years. So those have been my contributions. In addition to what I've said already, the main challenge facing the MDTA is the level of funding. It's not in the functionality of the organization. Where there's been a challenge when it comes to functionality has been staff retention, partly because we've had to keep within the 25% limit for administration and staff salaries. We've had to, the CEO has had to ask people to stay on. In our last meeting in August, we finally, eventually, were able to restructure salary packages of staff quite significantly after we went to ensure that we do a number of savings in other areas without going beyond 25% administration, the 25% threshold for administration. So that is going to remain a challenge because in the private sector, elsewhere in government, people are being offered on a continuous basis from the MDTA. So that's a major challenge in my view.
ANC, the political party, is intending to open up its own newspaper. What is your opinion about MDA funding political parties to establish magazines, newspapers, radio stations? Secondly, the ANC National Conference, ANC National Conference in Polokwane, had actually proposed a media appeals tribunal in which they'll be able to regulate part of the things that have gone gone quite bad in the media in terms of just going extreme and not having the right to reply in some of the instances where the media institutions are a power to themselves. We had allowed self-regulation, but obviously having seen the type of cartoons of Zapir and many others see that there is abuse. What is your view about the media development and diversity visas and a situation that there must be an appeals tribunal? Do you think that a media appeals tribunal will one or another hinder process of achieving maximum freedom of expression, multiplicity of views, diversity of opinions, and thirdly, for quite a long time, media and publishing in particular has been a terrain of people who are highly educated, and quite few people do not even like to write letters or to even try to reply to stories because of that. Now it looks like the current diversity and development have managed to give a lot of people voices, even those who might not be educated, like Mr. Julius Malema. Do you consider Mr. Julius Malema's views and opinions as a demonstration of a good media development and diversity in a society, apart from the other slogan that we think must like to talk about whether people are prepared to die or kill for any other person? But would you think that at least for the first time there is a platform for people who are not educated, highly educated, to be able to be listened to be able to get healthy stories to come through, does that demonstrate a good diversity of views, opinions? Those are the three questions.
Thank you. I think the provision of the MDDA Act about the MDDA not funding for illegal parties provides important reference for the question. In my view, it would mean that kind of provision is going to be important, because if perhaps it's opened up in a way which changes it, in a tense political environment, it could open the board, the MDDA, to decisions that affect, that could express bias. And in my view, that would be a problem. However, there's another question that I think you're raising. What is the adequacy of the public funding of political parties, including newspapers, if political parties want to have newspapers? In my role as a community officer, I was also the editor of Museveni and the newspaper. We had explored various things, looking at models followed by other groups, which actually have big public newspapers in Japan, in France, and Italy. And none of those models had actually included funding from public sources of the newspaper as such. But the one they drew, which was public funding, was the portion that public sources allowed for the political party as a whole. So I think the discussion has to be followed in that regard. And then, within that, the question would be about other sources of funding for the newspaper. Can it actually generate income on its own through advertising, through sales, and other activities? And as a political party, I think the ANC is in a different position from a private newspaper, because there's a culture, there's a loyalty in society that perhaps attaches to an ANC newspaper. So I think for me the challenges for such a newspaper would be in exploiting and optimizing those kind of associations and values that people may have out there in society. But insofar as the MDDA is concerned, I think we have to sustain that reference in the Act to the non-political bias of the MDDA insofar as it takes funding. The second question has to do with the Media Appeals Tribunal. I think the hysteria that we've seen in the media unfortunately obscures important elements of the debate. Judges are independent and they take their own decisions. Within that, judges are publicly accountable to society through the JSC, through what the Constitution says. So, in my view, if the debate is to be sober on the Media Appeals Tribunal, I think we have to think about it in terms of how the JSC functions. Because the JSC basically is a constitutional body, set up by the Constitution and then law, and then has got structural representation and has got fairly defined roles and functions and objectives. So in my view, I don't think the media industry should want to say it's not accountable to society. It's different to being accountable to a political party or a particular set of interest, So I have no problem in principle with the notion of a public body that the public can complain to about the practices of the media to ensure that there's fairness. And also, in my view, it could feed the impacts for development and diversification of the media. The question for me is, what is the terrain that defines that kind of public body? In my view, our president here as a country would be the JSC, because the speciality of the media perhaps in some instances can be viewed in a similar way to the speciality of judges, insofar as autonomy and independence must be protected, whilst also at the same time ensuring public accountability. The last question, look, I may not agree with Julius's views, but the third thing is that he may say whatever he says, whether it's correct or not, and so on. The third thing is that there is no space in the media which actually gets society to understand the conditions of people in townships and rural areas and so on, in a way which also gets people to explain the psychology or the ways of thinking of people and how they get to express themselves. To be crude and rude, when a township boy says that, yes, I don't literally mean they'll make you go to the loo, but actually it comes out of a particular social condition and how it expresses itself. Those who have researched hip hop, for example, would explain how hip hop would have come through, particularly because people have lived in the Bronx and Harlem. It would not, hip hop would not have come through in Manhattan, New York. Quite or similar, it would not have come through if it had to rely on social conditions and incentives. So, in the media today, given the bias that there is in terms of content, statements that get made by people who come from these conditions do not get understood. They get misrepresented. In the case of Julia specifically, I think he made a mistake with some of his views. I think he should have been able to express his political commitment in various other ways. However, after he has made the statement, what does then the media do? Does it continue to exploit a single sentence in a broader context of a statement, or does it actually enable a societal debate on his political commitment, but also the things that come up that are implied by a statement? I don't think we've had a chance as a society for a rational debate on the issues that he has raised, as controversial as they are. So for me, that points to the need for a sensitive media that is needed. And that does not mean people don't hold their opinions, people in the media and so on, but there's a way of reporting. Others, for example, would argue and say, during the 9/11 event in the US, we did not see bodies of blood, not a single body of blood, despite 3,000 people being killed. That's a particular medium, precisely, but there's a sensitivity, the sensitivities of people in that particular country. And yet, in our own country, we actually get things which offend people's religious and cultural sensitivities, or even social conditions. For example, if you read the Cape Times last week and the other week, they are reporting about the removal of foreign nationals in one camp back to the townships. Nortuk is suburbs and its residents, but Langa and Nyanga is a community. So you can see who's a suburb. You can see who's being referred to as a community. So for me, those are the kind of things that the media is just not sensitive to. I think.
Any questions?
Chairperson, thanks, Mr. Zaha. You have got a very interesting
be and even what you were doing. Because if you look at your CV and the study that you've been doing, it's not in line necessarily with your love, and that's the media, you know, if you look at land, agriculture, agrarian studies. You would assume the studies that you're following are where you're going to be, but it seems to be doing pretty well in both sides. Also, the other one, that your other passion, if I could call it that, question about. And as a Praetorian, I'm not sure. I think I should say pass on this one. But I would take this foot. It's between that. I can continue, but I could also leave the Supreme Minister if I lose that one. Let me take that chance. I'll follow back now. You know, it's difficult. Let me continue. This one that you've been also interested in is also, let me say, a person, you know, the person about the health issue, or the health activism, is serving on tech and gay and lesbian rights groups. Also, again, interesting. Now, when you do your training in MDDA and those kind of things, it obviously seems to be concentrated on the technical part, your management skills and thus all of that. But the social part that I want to cluster this under, this other passion of yours, of health and other issues, do you as the MDDA, while that's not your direct mandate, do you somehow introduce that as well when you do your training in terms of community media? And then lastly, myself and Arnold Schneeman has attended this broadcasting conference in Cape Town, and we've seen some countries, I'm not sure if they follow, that you'll find small countries like Togo and Senegal, I'm not sure how much democracy is there, and yet they have like radio stations more than 200 compared to ours that's back in two. They use the analog system, and I don't understand why we are so slow, close to reluctant to roll out more, particularly community radio stations, and to a lesser extent that are commercial. I'm not sure if you picked up anything through your stay at the MDDA, those kind of things, but there is a huge outcry for more voices, more diverse voices, more community voices.
Look, my future is a small-scale farmer, organic farmer in the Eastern Cape. So, however, I would want a small-scale farming unit covered in the local Kangama newspaper back in the village. So I think they can combine well with the various interests. The MDA up to now has really not focused on the content of what community media covers. However, there's been a change in the last 18 months. There have been three important partnerships with the Department of Local Government, Rochelle Local Government, and the Department of Education and Communications, where conferences have been held with local government and education to actually talk about the role of community media in cover development. And now what the MDA is working on is whether resources can be secured to ensure that actually that happens. The self-interest I think the MDA would have is that would amplify its own resources. The Department of Communication, the partnership with the Department of Communications has secured a sum of between 12 and 15 million, I forget the exact figure, over one financial year period. That money basically would be put aside to ensure food quality program. The debate the board had was what is the content of food quality program? Was told better development in general? What's the danger when it comes to the community media applying as weak as it is and then going for those resources, which are anyway in the hands of government and not as it meant for autonomy and independence? So that's where the debate was. However, what was said was that in the memorandum of the Department of Communications, there must be clear guarantees in that regard. But the MDDA were not silent to the development challenges facing the country as a whole. So it is a problem that the syllabus to be promoted through these funds to promote.
good quality program would actually cover development and social issues in terms of how the community media can cover them better. Because actually what people do is to get information from IOS and LAPC without actually looking at their own local stories that give their own local texture of what the other development challenges. So I think there is space for the MDDA in that regard to actually play an active role to ensure that community media and small commercial media are able to cover local challenges, local developmental issues. And in a particular way, the big problem is, in my view, the state of community media. From the early 90s when it rose up and got strong, I think there has been a decline in terms of what you may define as community media activists. You do get a number of people who are running community media entities who in the townships get referred to as socialites, who are basically there to run social fun, to provide fun, which is fine, which is important. But actually, they are not really a community-owned media station. They're not reporting on community development issues. And now, and also at local, regional, and provincial and national levels, there's fairly weak representation and organization of community media. The debate we've had, which we have not resolved in the MDDA board, is that in our view, the Act does not allow the MDDA to finance what you would call organization of the community media sector, which in our view is, well, you don't have a partner to speak, so to speak. There's a community radio forum, but you can't cover community radio for its own weaknesses, but there's no community newspaper forum, which there are small groups which are either independent publishers and so on, but there's not a real voices that are organized. So we still have to resolve this debate. What does it mean? Does the Act mean that we can fund the organization, the building of organization of an organized community media sector? Because if that organized community media sector is there, it can also begin to be a voice and pressure on the MDDA, but beyond that, lobby the commercial media, lobby government, but also mobilize its own resources as well. So there's still a debate to be resolved there.
In simple terms, it's just not known in the past. Now, I wonder if you have identified anything that you can do in the media sector in terms of emanating information to the audience. I saw nobody speaking on TV the other day. She was kind of herself and trying to hear herself talking about the life of Gensan. It was a talk show. And you could see that the audience was just something different from what you are saying. I don't know what role can create the end of this thing. And I'd also like to ask you about seeing that you have done some work for the city in the underlying causes of poverty. How do you think the MGDA would contribute to have feelings about it now that we have focused as one of our one of the issues that we are focusing on main terms of the ranking in poverty or housing in poverty? So many changes in the whole thing. Now we are at a stage where we want to eradicate. What role could we expect as an MD? Thank you.
Thank you. I think there are possibilities to partner with, to get the MDDA to partner with structures like the Commission on Gender Equality. The question is going to be, from an anti-MDDA perspective, in my view, would have to be, what does such a partnership contribute to the development and diversification of the media? And that's how I think the MDDA has approached the other partnerships I was mentioning. A practical example of how such a partnership could contribute is what the Workers' World Radio Productions are doing. They basically compile all labor stories and feed to community radio stations. So instead of community radio stations not having actually a slot on labor issues, there's actually a producer who produces the material. They conduct the interviews, they collect the stories, they prepare the releases and so on. Now, in my view, there's nothing stopping the MDDA getting into a partnership with the CGE on such a program, whereby perhaps the CGE, a number of gender organizations, rural organizations, come together and conceptualize what a program would be like if we were to focus on women, gender equality, and rural issues. The question would be, whether they actually people who can produce. I think they are up to now the only application the MDDA has received, which is close to that, is funding of two projects here in the Western Cape. One is researching the possibility of a newspaper for farm workers, submitted by the Women and Farms Project, and another one by the Media and Gender Institute on the West Coast, a similar thing too. So in my view, those are just that network, they are there, here and there. They're not coming with the kind of perspective or machinery the CGE would bring. So there are possibilities. But I think the model to look at would be the Workers' World Community Radio model, whereby there's a dedicated skilled producer who's got access to all the resources that the community radio station may not have. But then they use those resources to benefit all community radio stations. So that's one practical model I can think of in terms of what can be done. When it comes to poverty, I think the MDDA has a fairly limited role insofar as direct job creation, insofar as the impact on poverty is concerned. Where it could play a role is insofar as if the money that it gives as grants can be used optimally to contribute to other initiatives for local economic development or poverty eradication projects. Already, in putting up a radio station in the Alfred Zo district, you create a point of reference, you create a space where people can actually go and talk about the challenges they face. I'm mentioning this one because there's also an agricultural program which advises farmers in that particular area on how to, and they've been able to pull in experienced farmers, but also extension officers. So the community media can play that role, and the MDDA could encourage, for example, this partnership with Department of Communications, good quality programming in a rural area could mean the following key things that a community station such as an area must have. So in my view, it's that kind of role to ensure that community media actually provides coverage, informed, good quality coverage, and training is going to be important in that. A friend of mine, this has not come to the MDDA, but a friend of mine has got an idea that if you develop what you may call a community media index, whereby basically you are able to mobilize all community media into, not one body, but into a network, like a national supper of community media, whereby you've got this cadre of reporters who are
trained on poverty reporting, on development reporting, and are able to feed information across the country in a much more textured and much more informed way than a event-based journalist would do. So for me, that would be another contribution. Basically, Community Media Index would bring together all community media and would say a good community media institution has got the following attributes. And for want of who achieve those attributes, actually, this friend of mine is then saying, actually, bodies like the MDTA, Department of Communication and others have got a role to actually ensure that community media can actually achieve what the index needs as criteria for it to be considered a good practitioner of community media practices. So in that limited role, I think can every day can play when it comes to addressing the issue of poverty.
Thanks, Chair. My question really that I'd like to ask relates to the whether, in your view, having currently serving on the MDDA, whether the MDDA has done sufficient work to make itself create awareness amongst communities of the work and the role of the MDDA, and whether it's actually easily accessible. And in your view, what more could be done? Just to give an example, a person living in Diepsloot in Johannesburg and a person living in Mount Aylif in the Eastern Cape, what needs to be done to enable both of those people from those respective communities, one in the urban, one in the rural, to be able to access the MDDA and to understand the work it is doing?
Thank you.
One of the recommendations from the joint conference with the Department of Education was that actually media awareness should be part of syllabus. That is still going to take time, obviously, but that would be one key, because that would mean next generations not necessarily are aware of the MDDA, but in general the media. I don't think the MDDA has done enough to advertise itself to ensure that it is known, not just by the usual suspects in community and small commercial media, but actually by even people who would not ordinarily have thought of starting something like this. That lack of awareness is reflected in the fact that the Northwest, the Free State, and the Northern Cape happen to be the areas where there is the most minimal of support of the MDDA. And for me, that minimal support shows the extent to which there is not awareness of the MDDA. There have been several attempts, road shows, but also engaging, I think, the radio stations and community media in terms of MDDA spokespeople going to speak in particular programs. But for me, all of that is ad hoc. And the new strategic plan that for this financial year going forward talks to the need for a serious partnerships. One partnership mentioned is with the GCIS. I forgot the coach, multi-purpose community centers. Yeah. That has been the sites where of access. The limitation with those sites is that they're not everywhere in the country yet, but when there's an intention to roll them out across the country. Basically, then the challenge will be whether the MDDA can actually service an expanded set of multi-purpose community centers. I don't think we can. I think the MDDA can actually meet the current challenge with the limited number that there is. So basically, in my view, partnerships are kind of going to be important, but there's a challenge in terms of how much resources do you put to promote and increase awareness of the MDDA, because that also has costs. So there's also that challenge. I think the implied strategy, the implicit strategy of what the board of Janatuna has basically been to piggyback on DCOE, on DOC, DPLG, and GCIS. And I think that is the main. What has not been explored is partnership with the public broadcaster, other broadcasters, and commercial media. There was an attempt this year to get community media awards sponsored by the SABC, which I felt when I did very well, because then the MDDA did not have to pay for the cost of advertising that particular event and the hosting of that. It reached out basically through SABC radio across the country. But that was just once off.
So there's a need to systematize the network approach up to now into something far more coherent and far more organized.
Thank you very much for coming through and sharing with us and starting it. And I think we're going to be half an hour for your interview.
No, thank you.
Thanks very much.
I'm Kate Skinner, and just to take you through my CV, I have a background in the trade union movement. I worked for the South African Democratic Teachers Union, and at that point I launched a new alternative publication, which was the Educator's Voice, and also I was involved with the Teachers Publication, which was a publication launched by the Mail and Guardian and the Teacher Trust. So I was very involved in and also sat on the board of Reconstruct, which was a development publication launched by the Sunday Independent. And then after that, I then worked in Mvula Trust, which was a water and sanitation NGO. And then after that, for a number of production houses. So I actually then moved into the whole broadcast sector, which was very interesting, very exciting. So it was for a production house called Cascades Education Television, and then for Traffic, which is another one. And then what happened after that was that I was very keen on finally being able to finish my master's. And in fact, I had always been very interested in media diversity issues, and I then actually did my master's looking at media policy issues, but my dissertation was on the Media Development and Diversity Agency. And once I'd finished doing that master's, it was very exciting because I was then given some specific research to do on the Media Development and Diversity Agency. And I spent a whole year basically evaluating the institution for civil society. So I was actually contracted by the Freedom of Expression Institute to do that research. And then it came out with some very specific recommendations. So it was useful because I'd done my master's on it, but then I had the whole kind of practical evaluation consultancy sort of side of things after that. And then presently what I'm doing, I'm registered to do my PhD, and again I'm very interested in looking at media diversity issues, but broader than the MDDA. So it's MDDA, SABC, and ICASA, those are the three institutions I'm going to look at. And then in terms of my day-to-day work, I'm running this, coordinating this Save Our SABC campaign, which is a civil society campaign. I'm sure you're all aware of it because we've been giving a number of presentations to the committee, and we've been specifically looking at some of the legislation and your Broadcasting Amendment Bill, and a whole, you know, what we're campaigning for is a legislative review process. So yeah, my passion is media policy, media diversity issues, and I do have some practical experience in terms of actually starting new alternative publications.
Thank you very much.
There's a question there that invites itself to be asked.
Sure.
What were your recommendations after doing the master's work on the MDDA? What were the
Yeah, very exciting. I mean, at a broad level, I was saying two things. I was saying that the funding that the agency had been given was not sufficient if you wanted to make a real impact in terms of media diversity. Further, in terms of the funding, I was saying that it wasn't actually to the advantage of the MDDA to have voluntary funding arrangements with industry, because if you were really genuinely wanting to make a difference in terms of media diversity, you should be able to comment on the commercial media structures, and it makes it difficult if you've got voluntary funding arrangements with those very, very commercial media entities. So that was the first thing that I was talking to. The second thing was just about its mandate, and I was saying that, again, if you really genuinely wanted to make an impact on media diversity, the Media Diversity Agency needed to look beyond just community and small commercial media. It actually needed to comment, at the very least, on the commercial media structure and on public media. Because what I was saying is that media diversity impacts on all three media tiers, and they all actually work together. And therefore, it needed to play a broader role. And then I had a whole lot of different recommendations around it playing a much more proactive role in terms of advocacy. And there were like practical things like saying that it should literally have, every year a media diversity report on where are we at in terms of media diversity? What does ownership and control look like? Who's working on the media in terms of board level, management level? And it's not playing that kind of very proactive advocacy role. I then also looked at some of the issues around its actual operations in terms of the systems. And there were certainly some things that came out about the fact that, certain publications and radio stations weren't getting their funding timely enough. So it was, issues around fine-tuning those particular systems. What was interesting as well was to say that what needed to happen once the MDDA got to its 5-year sort of, been around and established for 5 years, is to actually then do some on-the-ground evaluations of, do people actually know that the Media Diversity and Development Agency is in place, are they actually getting more voices? Are they actually getting more media, so they're not just getting the one SABC, language station? So those were the kinds of things. They were very, very detailed recommendations around a whole host of issues, but broadly around it, a bigger mandate and more funding to have more of an impact.
The MDDA is there to do real work.
Mm.
It's not there to be politicians. Now, do you not think, if on your suggestion, they must now become an advocacy outfit? How would that impact on they have to do real work, and it's
real work.
It'll have concrete results. Real media, real diversity.
That's
how on earth is the, if they must now be advocates and politicians, how is that going to impact on
people? I don't think doing advocacy work is kind of political work in that sense. I mean, my understanding of the issue is that you actually have to look at the book. You have to do both. I mean, you have to actually fund concrete publications, radio projects, absolutely. I mean, and the bulk of the work of the MDDA needs to be precisely on those issues. But the fact is that those publications and those radio stations exist within a context. And that context is not necessarily conducive to publications and radio stations really being sustainable and operating in the long-term context. So what you're needing to do is to look at that broader context. So for instance, I'll give you a concrete example. Some of the big commercial media companies operate in ways that actually push out the tiny independent publications. So for instance, Caxton has played a role in terms of predatory pricing structures, which have pushed out some of the small independent media. So what you're wanting to look at is some of the practices of those big commercial media and to do some advocacy work around that. Because what is critical is to look at the context in which alternative media, small media, community media operates, so that you can have this diversity of voices. And I think that the MDDA should be playing that role too in looking at that broader context.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Ms. Maz. You ask your questions that relate to your master's program and dissertation, and I'm sure she's entitled to put her opinion. Because if you ask her in relation to the media, to the MDDA now, that would be a different thing. Chair, I want to check with you, Ms. Skinner.
Mm-hmm.
What is your opinion of an establishment of a media appeal tribunal vis-à-vis self-regulation? And I'm asking you this in relation to the protection of citizens, but also maintaining a vibrant media, you know, in that media environment. That's the first question. The second question is, I'm not so sure this involvement in the Freedom of Expression Institute, whether you've been seconded to work in the Safer SABC or you're there, and does that not create a problem for you to be in an institution, a Freedom of Expression Institute, and also participate in a structure like MDDA? Doesn't that sort of restrict your ability to get more critical of the media as a whole, or does that complement one another? Thanks.
Okay. So, in terms of the issue around the media tribunal, I mean, I've looked at that in some detail, and I think that the ultimately, I mean, the media is certainly not guilt-free, and the issue is that there have been problems around how the media has reported on certain things. And certainly, I mean, one of the big problems is there isn't a huge diversity of different views. On issues, and particularly in terms of economic issues, for instance, that there's one particular kind of economic view that comes through most publications and most radio stations, etc. So having said that, but I still think that the fact is that a self-regulatory system is a better system, just given the fact that there is potential for abuse in a state. Run media tribunal, and I mean I'm just interested to find out how the ANC would like to see that tribunal set up, because I haven't seen any of the details of that. But my immediate reaction to that would be one of caution and saying, you know what, let's try the self-regulatory systems first. Before anyone starts talking about a statutory body, so that certainly would be my sense around that. And I mean, the ombudsman is there. Let's look at that. Does it work? Does it not work? And certainly, you know, strengthen those systems first. Then you're asking me about my role in terms of FXI and how does my role in FXI work in terms of the Save Our SAPC campaign, and then also, you know, is it complementary or not in terms of me being on the MDDA board. What's interesting about the way that the Save Our SAPC campaign works is that it's basically a whole lot of different organizations that are part of it, a whole NGOs, trade union federations, it's organizations, but it's also individuals that are part of the campaign in terms of in their individual capacity. So what happened was that when I was then appointed as the coordinator, so in fact not actually representing FXI at all, but just being the full-time coordinator of the coalition, and I'm directly then I'm funded by the Open Society Foundation, and then I have to work with a working committee which consists of the FXI and Media Monitoring Project, MISA South Africa, etc. But my role is not actually one. It's too coordinated, and it's to balance all of those different views, but not to take a specific FXI view at all. In terms of my position at the moment is that I'm on the board of FXI, and I think that it's very complimentary for me to then also sit on the MDDA board, because I think what I would do is I would bring that, FXI has been very involved in community media issues, in fact has over the years done a number of community media projects, has looked at that broader context in which the media community media sector operates, and I think that experience and that knowledge would be the kind of knowledge and experience that I would then bring to the board. But I also think that I wouldn't be directly representing FXI in the same way that I don't directly represent FXI on the SABC coalition, and I think that I'm quite good at balancing very different perspectives. Because, I mean, Bamau, for instance, is not an alliance partner at all. I mean, you know, the Helen Suzman Foundation looked at the presentations that we had made and agreed, and COSATU had also agreed, and the SACP, and the Treatment Action Campaign, and all of those different parties with their very, very different perspectives, all have come to the party, have all been supportive of the campaign's work, and I, as a coordinator, have managed to balance all of those different views. So I think that I am quite good at being able to kind of see consensus, but still obviously say, you know what, in terms of what I believe is right, these are the things I want to put on the table.
I'm not sure whether that would be an appropriate question, I will try to make it appropriate. I'm sure if when we're dealing with the shortlisting process, a question has come out that you seem to be more of a coordinator than the actual doer in this matter. What is your take? That will be the one question. That you are more of a coordinator, but without the emphasis of performing in the industry itself, and so on. If I put it wrongly, but I'll try to put it nice. And then I'll go to the second question. What is your view about the relevance of NDDA?
Okay.
You see, I'm just raising that question in particular because these days the ruling party, of course, were under very pressure in terms of some of their policies to redress the imbalances of the past. And MDDA is one of the institutions which seeks to deal with those particular issues, but you must link up with that with the issue of ownership. What role do you think MDDA can play in terms of the ownership relationship, in terms of those who are dominating and those who are trying to come up with, so that we don't go to the issue of the first and the second economy?
Yes.
In this case, we have the first ownership and the second ownership of the media and so on, but trying to make sure that as they come back, they come to the mainstream in terms of ownership and so on. So those would be the two questions.
Okay. So you're saying that it appears that I'm more a coordinator than an actual doer. I would disagree with that. I mean, in terms of my work on the with the SABC coalition, I mean, all of those presentations, all that actual hardcore work around the bill, I mean, a lot of those presentations I wrote. I mean, I wrote them with the lawyers, and ensured that those documents were then were circulated. But the actual writing, the actual content of those documents came from me. Obviously, with a huge amount of input from other people. But I co-wrote all of those. So I think I am a good coordinator, but I think I'm also somebody that will write the actual content and get involved in the actual debates and so. But yeah, but thanks for that question. Then in terms of your question around the role of the NDDA in terms of ownership and control issues, I mean, that's a very key aspect of the actual act, is saying that it needs to change those relationships in terms of ownership and control. And I think the very fact that the NDDA has specifically looked at community media and small media and makes sure that there are more publications and more radio stations starts to change those media ownership and control relations and start to ensure that there are more people that or more disadvantaged groupings that are now being heard, but also are owning those publications and radio stations. But still, it's very tiny amounts it's not a huge amount of media. And that was one of the reasons why I thought that it was important for the NDDA to have greater amounts of funding so that it could have a bigger impact. And then also, I was saying that it was very important that the context in which those publications and radio stations operate needs to be more conducive to them surviving on a long-term basis. because you can have, you know, a situation where these publications and radio stations are set up and then they collapse and then new ones come in. And that's not helpful. What you're wanting is more and more, and for that number of community radio stations and publications to grow and be sustainable. And you want the NDDA to play that role. So that's why it's the bigger context plus those actual separate entities. And also, I must say that I was glad to see that the NDDA has just recently put out tenders for research to be done in the area of who actually owns the media at the moment. Because in fact, that research isn't really easily available. I mean, I looked for it for myself, and so we certainly. You know, it's a very good starting point to say that now let's look at who owns, and particularly in a new converged environment. You know, there are going to be some very interesting things that I think are going to come out of that research, and I'm hoping that the NDDA is going to use that to actually look at, okay, so what do we need to do about media ownership and control?
That's my question. Sure, the NDDA in Ghana, it's now going to account to the minister in the presidency. And the minister in the presidency is Dr. Manto Shakalanamsi. What would be your view in a situation that she's portrayed with a head of beetroot in the media continuously, and that she might believe that actually it is an insult to her, but it could also be perceived that it is a independent media depiction of her in a cartoon satirized environment. And now the NDDA, in terms of your view about how, I'm not saying that she will be now expecting you to throw a line you will still remain your independent, despite the fact that she will be the minister in charge of you if you are appointed to the board. Now, how will that then help you to maintain the freedom of expression, which is a major fundamental aspect of FSI.
Yeah.
And also B, having to, you know, guard the interests of MTDA, protecting your board against all these things. How do you see diversity in relation to your involvement?
So if you say like a superhero cartoon comes out with her portrayed as a big truth.
Yeah.
I'm asking
in the context of the question that I asked you earlier.
Yes.
What is your view about, because I asked you about the Center for Regulation and Media Appeals Tribunal, and you believe that we are moving towards self-regulation, but I can tell you, we are in a self-regulatory environment now.
Yes, no, we are.
Anybody can put anything on anybody, whether you portray the head of the person as a beetroot or not, but I'm saying now. To you, having to be in the FSI, having to be in the board of the MTDA, your board now, Ms. Dr. Manto Shalamsuma, portrayed to the head of the beetroot, and you now having to deal with these issues, do you see any contradiction, or do you think that your independence will not be compromised either way? That's a question I'm asking.
I mean, my sense is, I mean, the Media Diversity and Development Agency is about a diversity of views. It's about ensuring that all the views possible are out there. And the Freedom of Expressions Institute's specific mandate in society is to ensure that there are as many possible views out there. So my sense is there isn't a contradiction. Okay, specifically in terms of the portrayal of the minister in unsavory light. Well, for me the issue is that when you take up a political position, the fact is that you will sometimes be satirized in ways that you really don't like. Now you can use the courts to basically fight that case. But I as a freedom of expression activist would say that's what happens to politicians. I mean, politicians, you know, are out there. They basically, you know, I mean, they're going to be portrayed in all sorts of different ways. And if somebody is unhappy with the way that they're being portrayed, then they should they should use the court. It is my boss. It is my boss, but.
It means you can have a shower head also.
Alright, are there any further questions? Thank you very much. Some awkward balls coming, but that's how it is. Thank you for your time and for your patience. Member Sina suggested you just grab a cup of coffee or something, but we're not going to have a coffee break or tea break. Just bring these things in and then we can proceed with the next person. Mr. Moliese. Is it fresh? Quickly, you can grab some tea and coffee and then we can start.
You can't be crazy, love your heart. The moment you tackle it, that you can
members, can I just check the lunch is available? Do you want to grab your lunch and come in? I said the lunch is available as well. Outside. Do you want to grab your lunch and come inside? Let's do that, then we can save on time. Otherwise, we're really going to go into 5 o'clock later. There's lunch outside, is there? Do you want to grab your lunch and come in with it? If you don't mind, that's fine. We can eat while we question. Will that be in order? So, okay, let's grab the lunch. Then we don't have a full lunch break.
Thank you. Doesn't have an academic background, he has a lot of experience. And like you said, also on the job training. And yes, yeah, so even though that he had a lot of experience in community radio and community media.
He was an editor for a long time.
Okay?
He was an editor.
Yeah, he was. He was quite an academic.
Thank you.
We need to put this in, however weak it is.
Sure, the closing just opened.
My name is Salom Alife. I am from Soweto. I was born and bred there. I studied media studies at the Community Radio School, which was in Joburg a long, long time ago, well, 82 to be precise. I then went to Wits University for my first degree, and I did the management advancement program at Wits School thereafter. And I've had numerous attempts at master's degrees in media, but I couldn't go through because of work commitments and stuff like that. Career-wise, I've been an independent producer for some time. I've worked for the SABC, in the news research as a producer. I've worked for the Department of Labor, assistant director in the research department. I've worked for the Department of Foreign Affairs as a media manager, audiovisual manager, so to speak. I've run my own company as an independent producer, and I've worked for the Film and Publications Board as a head of classification. And I'm currently, which is not in my CV now, I've just been appointed as the head of broadcast and television at NEMISA. I really accepted the nomination to sit on the MDDA board because I really think that media development and I really think that the MDDA, you know, has got a lot of opportunities that they can explore within the community television sector, which is an area which is really not so strong from their business plan. You know, I haven't had anything, you know, that they've done for community television, you know. I am also a trainer, a skills facilitator. That is why I'm working for NEMISA, by the way, because my program, my company, I used to sit on the MEPSITA board in its formation in 2002, and I became a skills training provider as well and stuff like that. I'm very much interested in developing, you know, the South African television scenario in that direction, you know, and which I really find that, you know, it is not neglected, but it's a very television is very complicated, you know, and but I think MDDA can do better on that. I know they've tried. Last year they had a very interesting community television workshop in around April, and you know, I'm sure there's a policy framework out of that. And I know that sometime in 2004, you know, they tried to revive the Open Window Network kind of work that was done in the middle 90s. You know, but that's really what I'm interested in.
Thank you very much.
I just want to check with you in terms of the community radio and publications. As a person living right in that area, do you think that there's a lot that has came out of MDDA, and what further work needs to be done? Is it that we must invest more money on publications or on community radio stations, you know, in terms of the approach? Generally, which ones are the most effective tools of communication and building media development and diversity. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Kumar. I really think the MDA is doing good on radio, on funding and developing the radio sector. I think the MDA, if I'm not mistaken, they are funding about 90 community radio stations, you know, and through the National Community Radio Forum, and which is a good thing, you know. Radio is very much, I don't want to use words like feasible, you know, but it's one medium that is it is really doable, you know. I think that is why they are succeeding in that direction. But as far as the community front is concerned, you know, there's always issues of sustainability and stuff like that. I'm not so sure about the print media sector, the community print media sector, but I really think whatever they're doing fine, you know, because there's a lot of community knock and drop kind of publications out there, you know, which have an alternative voice to the mainstream print media, you know. But I'm not good up. I haven't read any research to that effect.
Thanks. Mr. Mulifat, during your stint at the SABC, you worked on bimedia. And if memory serves, bimedia was not a success. Would you just like to talk to us about the whole concept, which of course would not have been, you didn't invent the concept, but you did the work on it. Would you like to talk to us about that? And then the other thing that I would please need my mindset at rest on is, if you were a head of classification at the Film and Publications Board, that obviously occurred before the very contentious law that has just been making its way through Parliament. And although it occurred before that time, I would just like to have a sense of what is the kind of classification you were doing then. The Film and Publications Board started its life after the 96 law as a good free speech law. It wasn't infringing on free speech, but over the years there have been amendments. Classification originally was a consumer advisory function, apart from the really unacceptable material that got banned. But at the time you were there, what is it you were doing in October of 2006? And what are your views on censorship?
Okay. Thanks, Ulo, for me. The bimedia, the SABC bimedia project, yes, we know that it wasn't a success. I think it was an issue of really two mediums coming into one, you know, it was television and radio. And the way it was supposed to have happened, you know, it was a problem of convergence, you know. Here we're dealing with television and radio. They convey messages electronically, but, you know, television, it's more, you know, because there's pictures and stuff like that. You know, the way you prepare for your presentation on screen and the way you prepare for radio is different, you know. I think because of such problems, you know, it was just tiny little technical problems, you know, but it could have been a success, but it couldn't then, you know. Maybe if they can try it again, if it's really possible, maybe it can work, you know. It can work. Yes, I was the head of classification, and the kind of classification that we did was mostly your audiovisual products, you know, which was finished material that would get films from your major distributors like Steakin Echo, New Metro, and a lot of porn producers, and that's the kind of stuff that I had to oversee, you know, from the classifiers. That's the kind of work that I did. And publications, I don't remember ever seeing any publication during my time there, you know, because I can say because of the bill then. And because under general, you know, the kind of the output that you get from publications is not as contentious as the material that you get from harmful material like films, you know, like pornographic films and stuff like that, you know. Yeah, that's the kind of job that I did. Yes, I was there during the bill when it was pushed in and out of Parliament, and the freedom of expression, tearing it apart, SANEF having its way and ICASA, you know, there's a whole confusion as to who's supposed to be overseeing the classification of material, whether FPP will be allowed to do pre-production classification of publications and stuff like that. I was there during that time. Well, I don't think censorship is the right thing. You know, I really believe in freedom of expression, which is what the MDDA is all about. You know, which it's something that people are supposed to freely express themselves, as long as whatever they're doing is not harmful to others. You know, as long as there's a responsibility within that realm. You know, and really, I think the FPP, what they are doing there, it's to balance that. You know, you can produce your stuff, you can write what you want to write, and as long as it's not harmful to others, especially the children and the vulnerable communities out there, you know, who might not have the voice of reason. You know, they just receive harmful material and that's it. You know, so you balance.
Aligning yourself with the position of the Film and Publications Board on the subject of this new act, this new amending act. Is your position the same as that?
To be honest, I don't know the latest. I don't know where the bill is. I don't know if it's been promulgated. I just don't know.
It's through Parliament, but the position of the FPB throughout was they were the ones who proposed the pre-publication censorship of everything, newspapers, books, everything. It's unconstitutional, and therefore I really do need to know whether your position was the same as theirs.
I think the word that's used is classification, not censorship. You know, it was about that, and I think there was a realization that technically it was going to be impossible, given the amount of work that, you know, the output, you know, from the print media industry, you know, on a daily basis, that was not going to be feasible. You know, I left it at there. I don't know what's the latest, and, you know, I cannot really align myself with any views of that nature.
Mine will be very short. In your view, do you think that for us to realize the objective of MDDA establishment, can we progressively realize that through MDDA, or we need other means so that we diversify the media?
Thank you, Mr. Member of Parliament. I really think that the MDDA is adequate, just that it needs to be the capacity there. You know, you need to improve on the capacity, you know, the delivery, and really you have institutions like NEMISA, which are sister institutes to MDDA. You know, I mean, for instance, we do training on television, radio, and stuff like that. You know, and most of the time the problems are with, let alone the funding, you know, the training of media practitioners, alternative media practitioners, like the community television sector. You know, we can be able to do something about that. You know, I mean, practically in the Parliament, there's about four initiatives of community television, and all of them, you know, it's always a problem of capacity training. And you've got civil television, which is not doing so well because of that, and yet we have a place like NEMISA. We have the Bay Television in KwaZulu-Natal, the same problems. We have the upcoming Cape Town Community Television, you know. You know, capacity building, you know. MDDA is fine, but we can do something, you know, using other agencies, which can, you know, be a network of cooperation.
Jefferson, thanks, Mr. Molese. You know, when one looks at that cartoon of Shapiro, that infamous one, famous one, portraying the president of the 80s, loosening his belt, you know, all that, I'm sure you've seen it in the Sunday Times. There's opinion that says if that one would have been converted electronically, like our television, it would have been allowed to be shown. If you could just give me your view on that one, if it
translate that, Captain. Your community newspaper seems to be lagging way behind your community radio. Now, I at the time had the belief that our people don't like to read. But strangely enough, your tabloids, the dailies, seems to be the highest dailies in the country. That gives me an idea they are reading. And surely something must be wrong if they read tabloids quite substantially. If you take all of them, it's more than a million a day. It seems people are reading. How come that the community newspaper don't seem to take off at the same level or close to the same level like you would find with the community radio stations? And what do you think that we need to do other than just throwing money at it? Is there something else that we're doing properly? Why we can't be close to the success of that? Because I believe that we should read. We don't read enough.
Thanks, Mr. Parliament. I think there is a bit of a cartoon, you know, when you're asking me if we had to turn that into an electronic product, you know, into some kind of a short film or whatever, or a clip. You know, I think the FP, the Freedom of Publications Act, says that, you know, there's certain things that needs to be considered, you know, the explicit nature. Perhaps if that was done in a very explicit kind of portrayal, you know, and the use of language and stuff like that, and if perhaps the statue there that's about to be done, that deed, you know, it had to be in a very explicit and sexual nature, and the kind of language that's going to be used there, then you classify it in different context, you know. So that's how far I can answer you, you know. It depends on those things. The classifiers look at those things, you know, the language, the graphic nature of it, the sexual nature of the product itself, you know, and whether it would be harmful to anybody, you know, who would be consuming that, you know. And as far as the success of community media, whether versus the tablets, you know, I don't think it's a matter of choice, you know. People like to write commentaries, something that things that are written in a very in a very not comical but humorous, you know, but not so much of heavy information kind of laden journalism, you know. So maybe that is why. That's just my thumb sucking, you know. It could be that problem, you know, because if you read the tablets, you know, tablets are just easy reading, you know. People just read the first page and then read the last page, which is in the sport most of the time, you know. Maybe if there could be any some kind of research which can really give us that kind of perceptions of readers, you know.
All right. Any other questions? Mr. Malisa, thank you very much for your time. Is there still a question? Thank you very much for your time and for bearing with us and keeping you waiting.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Doctor. Very, very simple. You're going to speak to CD for about 3 to 5 minutes, and then you take a set of questions from the members, and they can ask you anything you have. Very informal procedure. So close you.
Okay, I'm currently a senior lecturer at the Centre for Film and Media Studies at the University of Cape Town. I've been at UCT since the 1st of December 2001, an odd time to join an institution at the end of an academic year. I have a background in English literature, and pretty early on I was keen on moving away from literature into what is called cultural studies at that time. Essentially, it was a version of media studies, and what I did was combine my background in English literature, that methodology, and apply it to a moment in South African media history. The moment I focused upon was a hip-hop group in South Africa, in Cape Town, Prophets of the City, the moment at which their music got banned during the transition to democracy. That led to a career in print media specifically. Editors were not interested in me because I had an understanding of black youth culture during the transition. This is just before Kwaito as a genre of music had taken shape. So essentially I got quite a bit of work with SL Magazine, with Wire Magazine, with the Mail and Guardian Friday, the art supplement. So quite a bit of writing on black youth culture, but not exclusively, it was a way in. Also around the time, I started to generate academic research, and as far as I know, I was the only South African in 1996 to publish an academic paper on black youth culture, specifically on hip-hop. So that this pretty novel and gave further opportunities on the academic front. I pursued my academic career in this area that would later come to be known as media studies. At that time in Cape Town, we didn't have a media studies or film studies department. The closest we came to it was the University of, what is now the University of KwaZulu-Natal, Kian Thomas Study and Ruth Tier Thomas Studies, Center for Media and Cultural Studies. But that was pretty much the exception. There's also another area which came close. Rhodes had a journalism school. Cape Town didn't have such a thing. It wasn't until the Center for Film and Media Studies was established in Cape Town that became a real option to be interested in media studies generally as also journalism. It includes areas such as print production, electronic media, video production, and radio studio. So this is where I am located. I did my PhD in the Center for Film and Media Studies and converted my PhD research into a book called Stealing Empire, A Money Drop, which is available under a content license. The publisher is HSRC Press, a leading publisher which has taken the bold step of making all of its, most of its publications available for free under an open content license as a PDF file. That is essentially what I advocate in my research, which is why I'm interested in the UDDA. I'm wondering how open standards, the logic of open content licensing, open standards generally beyond the licensing itself, how that can be used to interest, not to scale, to empower grassroots media producers. One example would be video. You have, as I understand it, has funded video training, video production training, etc. But the problem is that the software and the hardware is incredibly expensive. Can open content licensing be used? Open content software, I mean open source software, as well as open content licenses beyond the software, can that be used to make it cheaper for video producers to get training and to produce media and to distribute it? How can digital media, specifically the internet, how can that be used to actually give people access to production tools, but also to access communities outside of South Africa, connectivity to the continent, for example, to tap into a broader, imagined community beyond the nation state of South Africa. So that's where my research interests are at the moment. So starting with hip-hop and counterculture and black youth culture, but it's actually now
about media studies and Vietnamese media and how media can be used as a means of serving citizens in a democracy. A lot of the publishing publications that I've done have been either on intellectual property or black youth culture in South Africa. As a lecturer, that's what I largely teach, but also I teach in other areas besides black youth culture and film. I teach areas, things such as Indian diasporic cinema, for example. I've been interested in Eastern film, like from the hijack stories and its peakers with Mark Fuller.
Thank you very much.
I'm too fascinated. I just wondered if Dr. Haupt could apply this exploratory vision he has of open. It's essentially free, isn't it? A free film or video. How would he apply that under the whole rubric of the MDDA? And what that boils down to in the real world, I suppose, is who will pay for the production in the first place, right? You're postulating, I think, a situation where nobody then holds the intellectual property rights. But the Independent Producers Organization in South Africa, which is the wonderful people who make series and movies here, their big hurdle to their future is precisely that their intellectual property rights are not sufficiently well protected, because you have to make money just to exist and to make more beautiful creative products. So their experience would be very different from what you are suggesting, and I would just like to think through how it could work. Would it involve the MDDA, which is already not the richest outfit in South Africa, until the broadcasters start giving their money to the MDDA rather than to the Universal Service Fund? But there's a whole new snag in that to do with digital migration. But so, is that essentially what it would come down to? That someone would be paying for the productions. Nobody has the intellectual property rights, and it is free. It goes everywhere. Does it go on all community media, or can commercial media screen these things too?
There are a number of things that need to be unpacked there. First of all, I think, let's start at the beginning. Open content, the logic of open content starts with open source software. There's a common misperception that when people say that the software is free, it means as in free as in no cost. It actually means free not as in free stuff, it means free as in free speech. So, for example, the software that makes the internet tick runs on open source software, bind, poll, TCP, IP, all of these things, but open source software, it wouldn't be affordable if it wouldn't free. Microsoft's business model, Microsoft cornered the market as a global a software producer by giving away MS-DOS for free. Microsoft, good disk operating system. So it's free, everyone accesses, it becomes an integral part of our lives. And Microsoft is able to build a business off of that. So the easy difference between giving software for free, which is a part of the story, that what we talk about when we talk about free in the open source movement is essentially a scenario where we are allowing other people to access the source code of the software. How did you make this? Let's see how you made it. How can I learn from it? In other words, you don't lock down the source code. It doesn't prevent you from using your software, from selling it to vendors. It doesn't prevent you from making money off of services, which is actually more profitable scenario for any business. How do you apply that to cultural production is the big question. How do you ensure that people don't hijack your content? Now, open content licensing allows you typically, for example, the Creative Commons license, allows you to specify upfront, you as a user coming to my website or coming to my form, can I upfront what you can and what you can't do with my form? as opposed to locating the leadership that I've disappeared off the face of the earth. You now want to use a false clip from my movie or some media snippet that's integral to your fault. This is a documentary on the history of apartheid. But you can't locate me because there's an all-night reserve before Chappy on the DVD on this thing. Your lawyer says to you, don't use it. Don't use it because you don't know when the night soul is going to come out of nowhere to sue you for money you don't have. So that's what happens. This is how speech is impeded in a democracy. So now you can't access it. Some of the material is about cultural heritage, about a history. Especially with media, a lot of content is locked down, and we simply cannot use it because someone's going to sue us. How about if you license this content up front and you said, some rights reserved, you may use this to make commercial works of your own, or you may not. You make derivative works of this thing. In other words, transform it in some way, as long as you attribute me. All I want is attribution. So you can specify the authenticity, see elements through that license that you can specify. So some of it includes the commercial price and others exclude it. Your average form maker would be interested in that, because now it means you can source media snippets from all over the place. And you know upfront what you can do. I don't have to pay you, you said all you want is attribution, I want attribution. You want a cut. You want me to approach you with full permission. I may not usually work for commercial purposes, but now at least I know how to find you. I can go to you and say, make an exception for me. It doesn't preclude another night holder of the original work from making money out of it. So that's the one layer. How do you make money out of your full part of your music? That's an important thing. There's another layer to this. Total, for example, sound production software, which radio produces you, costs the earth. Now, I have Total at home, I've installed it in my Mac, I've got a digital design module that goes with it, and it works with the software. I must fill out various product keys in order to make the software work on my Mac. I discovered, this is December last year, that the product keys that I've been given are all incorrect. I purchased the software legitimately. I cannot use my product, I cannot use the plugins, because the keys are incorrect. Now I begin to mail DigiDesign, which is located in the States, and I have 3 or 4 months of email trying to get this cleared up. So that's 3 or 4 months in which I am not producing an audio product for radio or a CD for whatever. I'm not making media, even though I've purchased this thing legitimately. I don't have the same problem when I buy a car. When I buy the car, the first sale doctrine says, you bought the car, you can modify it if you want it. You can use it however you want. You can take the roof off. You can do whatever you want. Okay, as long as you don't tarnish our brand. Okay? Why does that not apply to digital media? And how does that very proprietary approach to software impede local media producers from the South, from the global South? How is it making it more difficult for them to produce media? It's making it incredibly expensive, and even if they can't afford to buy the software, they can't use it as well because of all these complications. They're locking this stuff down with laws, with end-user agreements, and then in the process they make mistakes, as the case with my purchase. They made mistakes. So, I mean, there are serious problems there as well on that level, on the level of the software. So the thing that makes media production tech is actually not hardware so much anymore, it's software. So there's a problem that needs to be solved. And that is about giving people, allowing people access that they actually have right, you know, the right to. So it becomes an access to information issue that needs to be addressed. Am I answering all of your questions? Can I answer that question? Essentially, the MBDA is geared towards promoting diversity of media, geared towards allowing people from all class and race and gender backgrounds to access the media, not just access it, but to participate in the production of media messages. We're in a scenario where media largely is dominated by corporate entities, and I think a part of why the MBDA exists is to acknowledge the inherent party of South African context, which is dominated by the state, which controls the media. That's one part of the story. And it is not story of corporate globalization, where, you know, O'Reilly, Tony O'Reilly, and Rupert Murdoch, a whole number of industries own a wide number of media entities, not just print media, television, that colonized the internet, etc., etc., and then using intellectual property with a very, very narrow definition of copyright in order to lock down their content. How do you counterbalance that? You actually do need mechanisms like the MDA that creates the space, legally and financially, for local producers of media, be they entrepreneurs, be they advocacy groups, be they community media interests, to allow them to actually enter the media game as radio producers, as print media producers, as establishing web presences, all of these things. And as I see it, training people to make media is one part of the story. The other story is getting them to understand how intellectual property rules work and getting them to understand that proprietary approaches to intellectual property, the lockdown approach, isn't the only way in which you can make a more collaborative approach is quite productive. We can actually do share, engage in culture share, but that doesn't preclude you from making money. So when I talk about open content licensing, I'm not talking about a scenario which is anti-private law. It's really squarely within the framework of private law. It's pretty much consistent with our existing copyright legislation. In fact, the person that nominated me, Andrew Yen, is the lawyer who was responsible for adapting the Creative Commons license, which is an open content license, to South African private law. But it's very legal. It's not anti-private law. It's not against the mainstream. It doesn't advocate piracy. It's a way of making money in a way that actually promotes competition and does not allow for monopoly. And what we have in this country right now is a situation where National Pass, for example, and independent newspapers actually own community newspapers. In fact, independent newspapers have the community newspapers thing, it's called community newspapers. They own a wide range of community titles. It's a bit of an oxymoron. You can't call those titles community newspapers if community don't own them, if community does not edit them. It's a very centralized way of producing those things. It comes from newspaper house. They employ a few journalists from those communities. But it's very, very, it's geared towards generating advertising revenue. That's the key revenue scheme. All of the slip-ins and all of the newspapers, that's how they make their money. They make more money from that than they do from selling the articles of the Cape Times. How does that happen? We're talking about the monopolization of the space that should be occupied by members of the community. Now, I'm very, very glad that Nationale Press, through Media 24 at the least, is supporting the NDDA to create this kind of space. Is an acknowledgement that you do need grassroots media, you need civic media, you need citizens producing media, you need citizens accessing this platform. So there's a live and let live kind of approach with National Paris. I'd like to see the same thing happening with independent newspapers and other media monopolies, not just in this country, but you know, globally.
Any other questions?
I was once told by the chairperson I was in a meeting where there was the chairperson for ICASA. He said, you know, in the market up there, it's like to be in a sea which is infested with sharks. You put your hand is gone. You put your head is gone. Now, under that circumstance, do you think that MDTA can be able to progress it, ensure that we realize the ownership of this media by the previous disadvantage? Or we must accept that the market on its natural process, eventually you will see the previous disadvantage coming on the fold of the owner. What's your point I'm driving at is the issue of the state intervention in ensuring that there is the ownership of those previous disadvantage. And the argument against which the state intervention bad for okay. What's your view around that?
Well, that is especially in the fact that what George Bush has been trying to implement is on a nationalization program. It's time to say corporations have gone and messed up. You want to sell them out. Why is nationalization good for the G8 countries? And why is it communism when we do it? John Maynard Keynes, a key economist, gave us key thinking in the development of such entities like World Bank, climate, and so on and so on. He, after the Second World War, proposed that the countries that are now G8 countries, in order to construct those economies after the Second World War, you need to protect local markets, you need to protect local entrepreneurs, and that means that legislatively you protect those players. The state intervenes in those local markets. And that's how those countries, Germany, Japan, States, France, United States, all of these different countries, that's how they became powerhouses. They protected their local players. A few decades later, the new economists, the post-Keynes generation of economists at entities like World Bank, tell African countries, South America, American countries, that when they do that, that's communism and it's bad. So they go off and they give the like Malaysian Japan advice, Malaysia specifically, the Malaysian meltdown is a good example, advice that they know is bad, that advice that they themselves shouldn't take. So there's an argument for state intervention to protect local entrepreneurs. There's an argument for that, provided that the constitution is the democratic one, the constitution that the guarantees of freedom. Of the inequal freedom of another new calendar, of another new year. So you have to have both respect the autonomy of new media producers, of cultural producers, but at the same time engender their creative supportive environment for them to exist, to sustain themselves, whether they're for profit or non profit. A key thing that I like to say in my lecture on the topic of media ownership is it's there for itself, the market. The markets will do what they always do, they will secure profits. Their responsibility is towards shareholders and not the citizens. What an organization, whether a statutory body like the NDA, does is to ensure that citizens are able to use media in ways that suit citizens, that not consumers. In marketing speak, the B2C succeeds in the B2C communication. This is the customer communication. C and B2C always means customer to corporations. It never means citizen. And it certainly doesn't mean creator. You must consume, you must not get, you must buy, you must make. Okay? Buy stuff. Clothes that are not made locally. That person make your own stuff. So tailor, workout, canvas business. That kind of cynical scenario. That's how Duchess got into trouble. So essentially, a mechanism might be in NDDA ensures that media can actually play the part of the fourth estate. Media studies students learn that we have seen in the government key estates, news media plays the role of the fourth estate. News media is the watchdog that looks at abuse of power on the part of the state. The fourth in that model was developed. We didn't imagine that corporations themselves would have as much power, if not more power, than national governments. And in many, many countries, the sorts of profits generated by transnational corporations dwarf the GDP of many countries. So these are your problems. So media not just needs to be protected from state abuse of power, news media specifically needs to be protected from corporate abuse. That's why statutory bodies like the NDDA, they exist because you create spaces where citizens can learn to become producers. If they want to leave community media and become, part one of the 9, whatever it's called now, P48, if you want to go into corporate media, fine, go. At least we've skilled you. It's one more black person in the commercial media sector. It's brilliant, it's wonderful. But there'll be people always be focused on using the media to serve citizens, serve the common good beyond commercial engagement, and that is a good thing for the marketplace.
I've also got a question for that. Would you support the proposal of the ANC for a media tribunal? Will that restrict freedom of expression? Or do you think the media tribunal can play a powerful role in curbing the power of copper?
That's a difficult question, because in abstract, you might say yes, but the context in which that has been proposed has you wondering about the motives of the people proposing it. If it happened outside of the context of, you know, the transition from the American government to this new dispensation, then if it happened outside of that, then I would say, well, maybe that's a good idea, but it depends on who populates the tribunal, how representative it is. We do need some sort of mechanism that tells corporations you may not enter certain spaces. Fine, make lots of money off the internet if you want, but if certain spaces on the web, if certain spaces are ready or print media, but you're not allowed to access it. So I think the MPDA is possibly a better route to go, partly because it attempts to engender and create those spaces, but in partnership with certain corporations that support the solution. But then it also potentially has the power to lobby government to create a legislative framework that creates spaces for community media, for local entrepreneurs. A good example, and I just said this earlier in my Indian cinema lecture, part of the reason why Indian cinema and media is so big and is going global is because they have legislation in place that prevents American media corporations coming in and gobbling everything up. So you don't have as big a presence of you know, media and film companies in India as you do in South Africa. Why does Tony and I own so many of our print media titles? Why don't we own them? Is the question to be asked. It's partly because we don't have legal mechanisms that say that's not possible. And if you want to come to our country, you must partner with us. And I think the threshold on how much media foreigners can own in India is something like 25%. You can't own more than 25% of any media corporation. That's not a bad thing. You don't need a tribunal, you just need to change the law to make that possible.
But man and body is all right.
Excuse me?
Yeah,
if it wasn't for that particular bailout, Mailing Guardian might not exist today. That's true. Perhaps we'll make an exception for Africans, though.
Yeah.
Doc, I'm fascinated, and I think I can call this one of your love or pet subjects, the question about music, particularly hip hop, quite rap, maybe including house in that. The reality is that's the vehicle that the youth is using to talk to each other, communicate to each other, all of us. And yet, all of us, including government, tries to deny that vehicle's existence. You want to talk to the media through people that is as old as the country, using people that have to push start. Deny this existence, you want to use gospel that is good. Even gospel goes hip hop and that's all about, because it's that form, and it seems to continuously get it wrong. Now, if you listen to some of the community radio stations, they seem to also get it wrong. And yet you find a youth everywhere. Why on earth are we continuing to repeat the same mistake? At some of the community radio stations seems to struggle forever, since the day they started, it seems to struggle forever because they don't seem to get it right and learn these lessons. I've seen it down where I'm deployed, where people are basically raps about anything on earth, from politics to church. And yet when we do talk to them, from the parents to politicians, we talk to them in a foreign language. Do you see if you should be part of the MDA, that you somehow start to change the mindset of those that goes out to train those people? is not to train from this is how it should be done, but how to do it best. It's to read the community in the language of choice. And the language of choice could be Igbo. It could also be gospel, it could also be soul. But to have that ear listen to that, instead of saying to the community, this is the final product, this is how you will listen to it. And not seeing and understanding that there will come a time that the people will turn their back on the community. Right? Isn't that also maybe one of the reasons why the community newspapers are not successful? Because we try to be a little burger and a little for the real Sunday Times instead of communicating. I'm not sure where you can get a community paper similar to rap, similar to quite in that kind of format, but in a print format. Well, that's most probably how people want to listen to it. Do you think that it would be possible, particularly if you should be on the board, that we could try and sway, how do you call them, dinosaurs, but old thinkers, let me call them the old thinkers, into a new way of thinking?
I think a paradigm shift does need to happen. I mean, this is partly why I wrote the Theatre Game Plan. I mean, the key message is that hip hop continues, even though hip hop has been commercialized and we have been shifted in from JVs and the nanny. There's a very, very strong contingent of activists, informal social work, if you call it, if you prefer that as phrase. Even Teva, the Dalai artist, calls himself his former MC from the scheme, who the scheme is not famous for the song by not yet, mankind, calls himself the original social worker. Mm-hmm. And a number of hip-hop artists are actually not just musicians, and many of them don't come as musicians, they make a living as developing practitioners. They use their genre of music, the art form, whether they're jazz artists, b-boys, break dancers, that is, or rappers. They use the art to engage young people. They recognize that this is where young people are right now. This is what they're using. Previous generation used to be jazz, reggae, blues, as a mode of expression and as a means of modernizing mindset. There's a lot of activity. My research points to, for example, Bush Radio, a local community radio station, that acknowledges that that's where young people are named. This is the help of hip hop DJs, hip hop entities. I've got a Friday night show called Headwaters, which has gone through a number of generational changes, changed hands a few times, and now it's become the local spaza entity who call in, participate in shows. And if you want to have a sense of what the spaza artists are doing, you listen to the show and you hear what's going on. In our book, in my book, a lot of archicons, as well as, of course, the artists will participate in the show. And they're calling and they're open mic sessions by some of the internet art. Some of those people got drawn in. They were regular callers. They got drawn into a program called Alchemy, which draws on the thinking of power of faith, that kind of pedagogy of the object, that kind of thinking on education. Drew them in, and said to them, okay, you're going to be more than MCs and B-boys and whatever. We're going to engage in a critical theory course that will be offered at university. We're going to do it in a way that doesn't look like a university course, that has you leading theory by Michel-Marc Foucault, part of theory, a whole range of artists, Marx, authors, Marx, etc. And you're going to produce poetry and lines and visual art artists. Some of those people left what they were doing. Some of them were two brothers and a twin. They admit they would still be smoking and drinking on a Saturday afternoon on a deep course on talking about women. And now they are appreciating doing these things. And both of those brothers left their friends, their life behind them, and they're now studying at UCT. Well, two of them jumped over and have graduated and are doing postgrads. One other person left the corporate media sector. He was working for Jupiter Drawing Room of all places. He was a copywriter and graphic designer. And he one of the accounts that he had was the Levi account. Right? They were as corporate as they come. He left all of that. He's now a postgrad anthropology / history student. And he just left UCT to go to NYU, New York University, and he wrote another scholarship. Okay. And this is a kid who was a problem kid from kid thinkers who didn't fit into the school system. And went off some of it actually, went to Cape Tech and did this diploma and worked in corporate and realized, corporate, this is the main thing I'm trying to do, I'm trying to do this as well, it's not for me, I don't know. causes alchemy. It causes this Toyota. Now the other Toyota in like this, there's an international NGO called Baobab Connection, which is funded by Bovend, a Dutch funder, and they collaborate with hip hop artists from South Africa on the website. It's a space where hip hop kids from all over the African continent come together. So they constitute it as sort of an alternative public sphere beyond the public space booth offered by the respective countries. They come together and identify as members of an African hip hop community. And they debate issues that affect their lives, globalization, provision of water, all of these things that affect their lives locally. And they are connected to something called African Hip Hop on Cars, to which hip hop artists are also constituted. And both of those websites are used as vehicles for engaging young people about how politics and economic policies affect their lives on the ground. But it's also allowing them, specifically South Africans, allowing them to imagine themselves as not just citizens of South Africa, but to imagine themselves as members of the African continent, a part of the global hip hop community. All these stories. So when people talk about, you know, Generation Y, the post-apartheid generation being the lost generation, being the consumer audience generation, I know that they are activists on the ground who recognize what young people are saying, they recognize how they're saying, and they can engage them in their language. Another artist in the late, Marius Andrade, also known as Mr. Devious, who was one of these kids who was on the verge of becoming a gangster, who is on the cusp of being, he basically left school, he was up to no good, and he found hip hop, and he connected with organizations like Wish Radio, connected with a number of hip hop artists who were advertising with him in a creative way. And in the end, he ended up working with the NGO called CHED, Creative Education with Youth at Risk. CHED works with kids, youth just in Portland, for example, and then use hip hop, genre, poetry, and all numbers of different art forms to engage young people, to give them part of that life, to point them to an alternative direction. So, you know, there are really positive stories that can convince the NDEA that there are alternative ways of engaging that are not about generational top down kind of communication, but actually more about listening to where young people are at, what they're like, what are they doing, how do they network, and in working with that, respecting that. So there are healthy pieces that can convince members of the NDEA about how to lead a church.
Well, actually, I think we should stop there. Thank you very much. It's something that's beyond. I think I'm getting old now. I've probably accepted it. There's something that's happening out there that I have not understood properly. But thank you very much for this. Because the whole day listen to you. I must come to your lecture sometimes. Thank you very much.
I have a few cards that have the details of my book. Which is available at free download. You don't have to buy it.
Okay.
Go to the publisher's website, you are all the thing. You can just get in here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
And we'll start reading the book too.
Thanks so much. Okay. Thank you. Right, I think we've got now 3 telephonic interviews. Can we push on?
Yes.
Good. Because I hope we can finish by 15:30 or later. Now, is that, no, it's with Dr. Bosch, yeah. I don't think she's here. Yeah. Is Dr. Bosch here? Tanya Bosch. If she's here, we can take her, then she doesn't have to wait. Right? And then we can do the telephonic afterwards. If she's here.
I think it's a little bit.
I think then we should connect to Mr. Selda Kananda. Just get her on the line.
I'm worried about my age. Because my age is also, you know, when you get older, the magnetic element in your body starts to.
You're not
pretending
for being a
shepherd. No. Those positions, they prove that they are not happy.
Developed a program for Kaya FM in 2001, a program that focused, it's actually 2003. The proposal was sent through in 2001 and was only approved in 2003. A talk show that was focusing on health and well-being, specifically looking at HIV and AIDS, just looking at issues of underdevelopment in our country, how they impact on how we manage HIV, how we respond to HIV, and did that show for almost 4 years, then moved over to the SABC, actually was coached by the SABC from KFM. And my personal interest in media that focuses on health and well-being